This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Listening to All of the Books, a weekly show of recommendations and enthusiasm regarding the week's new book releases. This is episode 457, and today we are talking about books being released on April 9th, 2024, and more. I'm Liberty Hardy, here with Vanessa Diaz, and we're coming to you from BookRiot.com. Vanessa, hello!
Liberty, how are you?
Well, I'm pretty good. We just had Snowmageddon. Like, after, like, several days of, like, 60-something
degree weather. That's so weird.
Yeah. Well, they said we were getting 19 inches of snow, like, what? From Wednesday to Thursday. And instead, we ended up with, like, rain and snow at the same time. So we ended up with, like, 5 inches of slush, which is gross. And the power is out in more than half of my town. And well, it's not my town. I don't own it. But, like, you know, where I live. And there's just trees and power lines down all over the place. My in-laws, the power line fell in their driveway, so like my brother-in-law couldn't go to work yesterday. It's just, it's a mess here. So I'm very lucky to have power. But then right as we were getting ready to record, there was an earthquake.
That's
New York City. Did you hear this?
I did, yes.
Yeah. So, like, it's just all kinds of wild stuff is going on. So, how about you?
Yeah. I was talking to a staff member right before you and I started recording, who's in Jersey and said, obviously, y'all are not used to earthquakes on the East Coast. Whereas growing up, we took earthquake emergency kits to school at the beginning of every school year, just in case there was an emergency. And so it was like full of non-perishable food in a Ziploc bag, like that was going to help. But I'm not dealing with earthquakes. I'm still in California, where it has actually been, uncharacteristically rainy, even for us. But now it's nice and sunny, so I'm happy there. And I have a brand new baby niece, so that's exciting, after a very dramatic entry
owl
into
baby.
The world. Yes, our little owl baby. She's very small, but very cute. Her name is Mia. That's why I've been in California. So life is lifing. So much happening.
Seriously. I mean, we get earthquakes out here occasionally, but not like big ones, you know. There was one time, I think, did I work? I don't think I worked at Book Riot during the podcast then, but like I used to live in this very old wooden building, and we had a little earthquake and it like shook my book piles down many years ago. That was like the first time and the only time I had felt one. But actually last week I was asleep and I heard like and felt like this rumbling, and I woke up and I was like, what was that? And nothing had fallen over, but it went on like so that I was like definitely not dreaming it.
Yeah.
So I went to the internet and there was like nothing about an earthquake. But then I went to the security cameras in my house and you see my cat. Because I was like, maybe I did dream it. You see my cat. He's like asleep on like the half wall. And all of a sudden he puts his head up and runs because like I found them under the bed.
Oh.
So I was like, something happened, but it was like the end of arachnophobia. Like you just see like the security video, like every, like, I don't know what happens. We still have not figured it out. Like, I have no idea. Like they attempted to suck my house up into an alien spaceship. I don't know. But yeah, weird. It's probably something like, you know, the bricks in our chimney like fell down inside it, you know, because it's, we don't use it anymore. We don't have a fireplace. It'll be something like that. You know, we'll find it later, you know. But
decades from now.
Yeah, it was very strange. We spent like half a day trying to figure out what it was.
I mean, not that it could be this because of like where you, I believe you live in the vision of your town I have in my head. But like, because they happen so frequently here, we're constantly just like, oh, that could have been an earthquake. And half the time for us, it's because it's just some like major like a giant semi-truck rolled by on like a street that's been retrofitted. And so you feel the shake and it feels like you're having an earthquake, even though you're not. But I imagine that's like not happening a ton like on your street. I could be wrong.
Well, I live on the busiest street on the East Coast. And
oh, I don't think I do that.
Like we have that all the time. Oh, yeah. So this morning, well, first, before I go into it, let's hear from a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, so back to the earthquakes. This morning, actually, I live near a business that employs several thousand people, and they have shifts of like a couple thousand at a time. And because of all the power lines and the trees down, they all had to go by my house this morning. So like traffic was like, just stopped. You know, so you hear cars, but like even on a good day, there it crawls by at shift changes. And like you hear cars and you like hear these big trucks. And this was definitely like a... It sounded like it was on the roof, which was really weird.
Oh, yeah, that's
but
the aliens.
I don't know. Like, we went and looked at the roof, and, like, yeah, I guess we'll never figure it out.
Hopefully you're still around next recording, and you can report back.
It's fine. I mean, it was, like, last week already, so.
We're good.
It's, you know, the mothership tried to come get me, but they
ship's
failed
whole.
Or something. Yeah. They were like, oh, wait, no, not her. No.
No. Too many cats.
Oh, if they would just take my cats, that would be great. Just, oh my goodness. So we're going to talk about books now, though. We covered the weather, we covered cats. So now it's time to talk about books. Before we do that, I want to point out that the corresponding area code for episode 457, it says there's an upcoming telephone area code in the North American numbering plan that will serve the central and northern parts of Louisiana. I don't know how old this is, this information. Maybe you already have it. Maybe it's not happening now. But this one is spoken for, so no one else can use it, just so you know. Like, don't even try.
Got it.
Okay. And Vanessa, do you want to tell us about TBR?
Yes, absolutely. So if you are looking to elevate your reading life, Tailored Book Recommendations is here to help you with handpicked recommendations, as that title might imply. You just need to tell our bibliologists at Tailored Book Recommendations about what you love and what you don't, and then you can get your recommendations, which are custom to you, via email, or you can receive hardcovers or now paperbacks in the mail. We've got quarterly plans, annual plans, so there's something at TBR for every budget. Plans start at just $18, actually. So just visit mytbr.co to subscribe to TBR. It only takes a few minutes. Again, that's mytbr.co.
All right. So now we're going to talk about books, more books, books that we have read. I read this book so long ago, I can't even believe that I'm talking about it now because it just seems impossible. But it's very exciting and something like weirdly coincidental happened just before we recorded that doesn't have to do with the earthquake, but I'll tell you that at the end here. My first pick for today is A Better World by Sarah Langan. She wrote Good Neighbors, which I loved, came out in 2021. I was like obsessed with that book. It was about a group of neighbors in this picture perfect cul-de-sac, but like due to reasons, I can't even like think of what they were now. The neighbors start to not get along, and then they start to ostracize one of them or one of the homes. And then this giant sinkhole opens up in the street and things just get more tense and nastier. And it's just wild. And A Better World actually has a couple of similarities with Good Neighbors. It's about a family and it's about people seeking to live in a nicer area than most people can afford. And it's about people who think other people don't belong. And it also has another huge similarity, but I can't tell you what it is because that would be a spoiler, but you'll see it if you have read both. So in A Better World, we have Linda Farmer Bowen. This is set many decades in the future where you will not be surprised to learn that the world is a horrible hot mess like we thought it would be. And whole countries are gone. They've been destroyed by nuclear war. The environment is poisonous. There's diseases everywhere. Lots of cities have fallen into the ocean. The government has created a new drug to kind of keep people under control. And millions of people are addicted to it. And the United States is no longer, it is like now broken up into different areas. And more than 30% of the citizens are unemployed. So Linda is a doctor at a clinic. And her husband works for the EPA. But like they have hardly any money. Everything is so bad. They keep trying to get work and their neighborhood is very dangerous. They have teenage twins and the kids can't go outside because it's a very scary place. And like the environment, like I said, she was poisonous. Then they hear about this place called Plymouth Valley and they think it might be the answer to their problems. It's this gated town that was started by a family who invented this substance that eats plastic. The substance eats the plastic and turns it into a non-toxic sludge, which is helping to solve the plastic problem in the world because there's just tons of plastic everywhere and it doesn't break down in, you know, probably at all, as the recent articles have said, which we were told it would eventually. And so this family that started this town, they're like gazillionaires now, and they only have 5,000 citizens in Plymouth Valley. They have a few of these towns around, but you can only have so many people. And this was the first one and is considered the best of these towns. And somehow, through the magic of science, inside these walls, the air is clean. They have the best schools. There's no poverty or crime. And everyone, every single person is happy. And if that sounds too good to be true, it's probably because it is. But there's a position inside Plymouth Valley that opens up for Linda's husband. And so he applies for the job and he gets it. So they find out after that it comes with some rules. You have to put a deposit down to stay there for your first year and then you get your money back. But you also have to keep a weird DNA cloned bird from mythology in your yard. They're like these toothy, weird white chicken dove things. And you have to leave an offering in your house. Each house comes with a little altar. And you have to like, they call the celebration the Hollow. And you have to like leave a little offering on your altar in your house at all the time. But like, it's like some pomegranates, you know, on a pedestal in your home in exchange for like being safe and happy and clean. And so like, what's the big deal? But unfortunately, as soon as they arrive, Linda starts finding some problems. Actually, all of the farmer Bowens are having problems. The locals are not very nice to them. They're very cold to them and snub them. The kids have a terrible time making friends at school. Like, nobody wants to be their friend. Everyone's mean to them. They bully them. They want to play sports and they get bullied. Linda's husband's coworkers try to sabotage his work. And Linda just feels like, what is happening? Like, we were supposed to come to this like amazing utopia and everything is awful. But then she gets invited to join a group of the most powerful people in Plymouth. Like, of course, even though everything here is wonderful, there is a clique, you know, there's a hierarchy. And she is invited by this powerful clique to be friends with them. And all of a sudden, everybody wants to be her friend. She gets a job working at a clinic. Her kids are making friends. They get invited to all these things. But she still has this feeling like there's something going on there and the residents are not actually saying what they feel. And possibly some of them are even afraid. When an incident involving a resident who is asked to leave Plymouth Valley shakes Linda's world, she decides to go look for answers. And I was like reading this and I was like, oh, okay, this is what's going to happen. No, like I never knew what was going to happen. And I was so happy to always be wrong because it was super freaky and just really great. She has written this really amazing novel about the rot under society, as well as like a really great novel about a marriage. Like you know, Linda's marriage is going through a lot while this is happening and they've been together for a really long time and they've gone through things in the past. And it's a really great examination of like a long-term relationship like this. It's just so good. It gave off like serious, like Ira Levin vibes, Thomas Tryon vibes. It's like an Ira Levin tale for the 21st century. I do want to give content warnings because this book includes just about everything you can think of for content warnings. It is about a walled town several generations old where people have started to forget that some things are unacceptable. And it's also part horror novels, so just know that going in that there's a lot of content warnings. So what I was going to tell you though is right before we started recording, after I heard about the earthquake, I got a package in the mail and I opened it and it is a stuffed animal version of one of those toothy mythological bird things.
I was about to suggest that as a joke.
Yeah, it would have been real. It's a yes, Sarah Langan sent me. It's a, they call them a calat. I don't even know how you would pronounce it, but a caladrius, caladrius. I don't know, but they're super creepy. And this one is like a stuffed animal version that the publisher had a bunch made for her. And it's really awesome. And you'll probably be able to see it on my Instagram account soon, probably after I get done recording this. So it'll be there when you hear this. Anyway, I talked about this book for a really long time. I love it. It's A Better World by Sarah Langan.
Oh my gosh, yes, that is, it's a bird from Roman mythology, if I'm not mistaken, and now I am so excited to know what that is. I was literally going to make that joke. I cannot believe you actually have a stuffed version. That is amazing. So now I will tell you about my book that is a very hard turn in a different direction, of a nonfiction direction, and that is The Age of Magical Overthinking by Amanda Montell. Amanda Montell is the author of Word Slut and Cultish and the host of the podcast Sounds Like a Cult, which you may have heard of. It's one of, I love that show. I follow it pretty religiously. Not in a culty way, but it's a show about the, as they say, the everyday cults we all follow. So whereas Cultish, her book, I think I would argue her breakout book is very much a look at actual cults and some not actual cults maybe, but does do like a history of some like well-established cults. The show sort of seeks to point out that there is cultish behavior in a lot of the like things that we enjoy or follow or organizations that we support, people we buy products from, etc. So she's studying linguistics and is also really interested in just understanding the reasons, again, that we do what we do and think what we think as people, as a society. And that's sort of where the concept of this book comes in. The book's title is obviously an allusion to Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking. And though it is topically somewhat distinct, and I confess I've not read Joan Didion, the book apparently shares some of its structure, though it's not about like grief in the way that Joan Didion's is. It's a look at the ways that we overthink, as the title might imply, as a society. I saw a review describe it as an exploration of how irrationality went mainstream, and I think that is like a very apt summary. She begins with the definition of magical thinking as the belief that one's internal thoughts can affect unrelated events in the external world, which is a concept that I think most of us are familiar with at this point, if you're living in 2024. Through essays that blend research and interviews with a lot of personal anecdotes, she gets into the shortcuts, the like cognitive biases that we bring to our reasoning, and seeks to understand why we rely on this kind of thinking, even though we know it's flawed and often like puts us in a state of higher anxiety. She explores topics like the halo effect, sunk cost fallacy, imposter syndrome, stan culture, like celebrities, you know, culture, commercialized nostalgia, the health guru phenomenon, like health influencers, and other ways that we have been convinced, or convinced ourselves really, that everything is a crisis, and also that we can manifest our way out of it with our minds. It's really interesting. I'm going to just note, and this is not a bad thing, it's just that not everyone is going to rock with this structure, I don't think, because it depends on like where, how you're approaching it. Amanda Montell is very smart, very eloquent. She clearly knows how to break down big concepts into kind of smaller digestible chunks and how to tell like a fun, quippy anecdote. Like I haven't read Cultish. I've actually came to know her more through the podcast. And so I'm used to hearing her very like casual tone on the show. And reading this book, I was like, oh no, she's like got some serious writing chops. Sometimes that felt like a little bit maybe forced in some of these little anecdotes, but I don't think she needed to like be quite so, you know, mellifluous maybe, but that's the wrong word. But, you know, there were times when I was like, well, maybe you didn't need that. But like, it still was impressive and like enjoyable to read. And then the topics themselves do kind of jump, like they're not necessarily linked in like a super, super linear way. I don't think that's a bad thing. But I just think some people are going to be like wanting a more, yeah, like A to B to C kind of thesis-y approach to this. And that's not what this book is. It very much is more of a like meandering style. But her anecdotes are really interesting and fun. And again, she's a very like approachable writer, as well as just a very talented one. So yeah, I had a good time with this book. It was not what I was expecting, but it was great, and definitely reminded me of, yes, how overthinking is much more prevalent in your life, even if you don't think you do it, which I absolutely know that I do. So that again is The Age of Magical Overthinking by Amanda Montell.
All right. My other pick for today is The Gathering by C.J. Tudor. Tudor wrote The Chalk Man, The Drift, The Other People, several other books, if I'm not mistaken. I think I've read The Chalk Man, but I can't for the life of me remember it at this moment. So this might actually be the first book that I've read by C.J. Tudor, but this is about an alternate world where vampires exist. I mean, unless you think they exist now and then. Fine, but like this is like they're out in the world. In this world, the vampires have actually been around longer than humans, but at this point, humans have run most of them off. They now reside in colonies, and there is a VPA in place, the Vampire Protection Act. They are now a protected species, and they have a deal. I mean, they just look like humans, you know, but they're vampires. And so they have a deal with the humans. If they don't hurt the humans won't hurt them, you know, and if we don't hurt them, they won't hurt us. So this is like actual laws. You can get in big trouble if you break these rules. But there are also government sanctioned cullings of vampire colonies if they break the rules. And it hasn't always been like this. It used to be like anybody could kill a vampire. Vampires were killing humans. But now, like I said, it's against the law. And, you know, they live in these little colonies and they don't have it as good as humans. Even though they can do all the things that humans do, they, you know, except eat food, really, because they live off animal blood. They're not allowed to hold jobs. They can't drive. They can't run for office. They can't really go out into town. They have to make their own clothes and take care of their own medical needs, because vampires in this instance can get injured and they actually die, like of natural causes, but just a really long time later. You know, like they live hundreds of years instead of like, you know, 70 or 80. So this story is set in a very small isolated town in Alaska. And at the beginning of this book, a teenage human boy has been murdered, and it looks like a vampire has done it. Now, 25 years earlier in this same town, a teenage boy was murdered by a vampire, and it ended with several vampires being killed and their colony fled. But recently, in present day, the colony returned to their old living space, which was like this abandoned mine, and now there has been another killing. So is that too much of a coincidence? The townspeople certainly think so. They want to go and kill all these vampires at this colony. And I mean, lots of them don't even enjoy the fact that they live near vampires, you know, before or now. Some of them are even trophy hunters. They have parts of vampires up on their wall, like taxidermied animals. It is legal to have vampire parts. There are, you know, some that were like old and like grandfathered in, but you can't, you know, kill and take trophies now. So the police send a detective named Barbara Atkins to investigate this murder of this boy. And Atkins is a very thorough by the book detective. And the townspeople resent her being there immediately. They call her a vampire sympathizer. They just want her to sign off on a sanctioned culling so they can go and kill all these vampires. But she won't do it. She discovers that there are too many other unusual things going on regarding this case and the older case and things going on in town. Like so many moving parts that it would be impossible to describe them all here. And I don't want to spoil anything for you, so I'm not going to mention it. But on top of like this and her investigation, and some of the people in the town, we also hear from the other side, like a couple of the vampires as well, especially their leader. The leader of their colony is a vampire who is hundreds of years old. She is the oldest vampire and the most fearsome vampire, and possibly mentally unwell because she's been alive for so long. They don't think, you know, that that could be good for brains. And happens to be in the body of a 9-year-old girl. Think Claudia from Interview with a Vampire, but with 1,000 times more attitude and scariness. This vampire was turned as a child hundreds of years ago, which is something that is not allowed anymore. There are rules within vampire colonies now. Like, you can't kill other vampires. You can't turn children. But vampires do have children. And again, it's just like humans, except they grow much more slowly. They age much slower. So as Detective Atkins investigates the murder and looks into the old case alongside the previous sheriff who was investigating that case, who has now spent the last 25 years living alone in the woods for reasons, tensions in the town continue to build. This is a fun, nasty book. It has similarities to 30 Days of Night. If you've ever read that comic or seen the movie, you know, like, Alaska's a great place for vampires because the sun's not out a lot of the time. But it also gives me like 1980s vampire fiction feels that I haven't read in a vampire book in a while, like Vampires by John Stakely or Dawn of the Vampire by William Hill, or even Salem's Lot by Stephen King, which, as we are recording this today, is the 50th anniversary of the release of Carrie. But I digress. I really enjoyed all the backstories of the characters and the different plot lines going on at once. It's like Northern Exposure, but making vampires. But not really, just kidding. It's not nearly as racist or homophobic as Northern Exposure. But it does have a lot of content warnings, including racism and homophobia and everything else that you would need a content warning for. Like, seriously, this is a nasty vampire story. You know, when I say nasty, I don't mean bad. Like, it's a great book, but like, you know, gross things happen. These are, you know, frightening things on both sides, vampires and humans. And bad things happen to people of all ages. So go into it knowing that. It's very violent and it has a lot of gore and mentions of harm and sexual assault and death of children and adults. And that's just for starters. I will say, I don't know, I know that it's fiction and vampires aren't real. I mean, unless you think they are, and that's fine. But it did feel a little icky to hear them mentioned a couple of times in the book alongside other marginalized groups, but maybe that's, you know, just me. That was just my feelings. But it's still a deliciously gross and fun book. It is The Gathering by C.J. Tudor.
Shout out to all the Twilight people who heard you talking about how you're not allowed to make vampire kids. You were like, ah, yes, there is a rule against immortal children. I'm not necessarily proud that that's where I went, but that is absolutely what happened.
Yeah, I mean, you can make your own, but you're not allowed to bite human.
Don't bite.
You're not allowed to bite human kids anymore.
Yes,
because they don't age, like they don't grow.
Yes,
unlike vampire children. So, and you get creepy little kids, which I mean, like that's like the perfect thing. Which also reminds me, I just saw a trailer last night for a Vampire Child
Abigail
movie. Yes. So,
yes, see, I really creepy. Like Melissa Arena was in creepy. That, and I was like, ooh, yeah, Vampire Child. I don't know. Anyway, Vampire Children, bad. My book has nothing to do with any of that. There is a sheriff. That's the connect. Anyway, my next pick is Daughter of Mine by Megan Miranda. This is my first time reading Megan Miranda. I've been in a place where I just kind of need thrillers and mysteries, like keep my brain going a little bit. So this is one that I picked up for that. So it's about a woman named Hazel Sharp, who is the daughter of Perry Holt, who is the longtime local detective and like favorite detective of a town called Mirror Lake in North Carolina. Mirror Lake is a small town, and she's come back to attend her father's memorial service, and that's why she is in town. She now lives in Charlotte. Her father, though, is not actually her father so much as the man who raised her. Her mom bounced her around a ton as a kid due to having a really terrible father and essentially just kind of always being scared for her life due to making some, you know, choices along the way. But they've settled for longer than usual in Mirror Lake when her mom gets together with Perry Holt. But then she very suddenly disappeared when Hazel was still a kid. She was loaded down with a bunch of jewels and money. She packed up her stuff, got out of town, took her car, you know, never to be seen again. So Hazel has long felt abandoned, of course, by her mom and like hoped that she was out there just living her best life. But of course, like heartbroken that she never came back for her or reached out to her. And so that's how Hazel came to be raised by Perry, living with him and his two sons from a previous marriage who she considers her brothers. But the visit does not go as planned. For one, Perry's will reveals that he's left his home to Hazel and not to his like biological sons. That goes over super well. And secondly, and most crucially, Mirror Lake is experiencing a drought, like a severe drought. And that means things are coming to the surface in Mirror Lake that were once buried deep. And that is how Hazel discovers, sort of through her niece who goes swimming and detects it, that her mother's car and suitcases have been at the bottom of that lake. So maybe she didn't leave after all, didn't abandon her daughter without looking back. You know, maybe she met with foul play. In fact, it's looking, of course, like that might be the case. The circumstances get even weirder because there have been a slew of break-ins in the town. Two people now go missing, including Hazel's former best friend, who is married to and has a daughter with one of her brothers. And Hazel isn't sure if she can trust those brothers who are also in law enforcement and seem to kind of all be part of like a closed loop, you know, club. So they don't seem to keen about her getting everything in the will or to like take any of her concerns about everything else that's going on seriously. And that is, yeah, where things go. She's trying to figure out like, did my mom disappear? Is there something else going on here? Like, why would my dad leave me this house? Like, it seems like we all thought he was going to leave us like a fair chunk of cash. And it seems like his accounts are empty. And like, why is that? But there's also maybe these interesting payments. Like, what is going on? So there's lots of little pieces that have to come together here, and of course we'll let you discover that part on your own. It is like a domestic thriller, and I don't say this and again is like a bad thing, but like there's gonna be, I think for some people, like a relatively predictable ending. For me, I still, like right when I had kind of resolved myself to like, oh, I know exactly how this is gonna pan out, there were definitely some twists, so it was fun for that reason. And I just always like those, I don't know, whenever you throw a lake in like a body of water for whatever reason, I'm like, ooh, the mystery is in the deep, even though it is just a lake. So that got my attention and it was just a good time. So that again is Daughter of Mine by Megan Miranda.
All right. And now we're going to hear from another sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Lee Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Lee Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social-climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Lee Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeeBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Lee Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
Whew, okay, now it's like we're gonna have to talk very fast about the next ones because all of a sudden we have talked for a very long time about the books that we read, which is awesome. You know, we have a lot to say about them, but you know, now we're running out of time. So my first pick for books that I have not read but I am excited to read is The House of Broken Bricks, which is really fun to say, The House of Broken Bricks by Fiona Williams. It is about a married couple, a Jamaican woman named Tess and her white English husband, Richard. They move to the English countryside and things are very different there from her life in Jamaica. And Tess really misses it. She doesn't know how she feels about being there. And then she gets pregnant and she gives birth to fraternal twins. And one of the twins presents as white and one of the twins presents as black. And complications arise from this. One of the twins, you know, will obviously have an easier time in England than the other twin. And also at this time, Tess is still missing her home. So how will they make it as a family in this world? It has, according to everything that I've read about it, just beautiful writing. It's supposed to be an amazing debut. It is The House of Broken Bricks by Fiona Williams.
That is fun to say.
Yeah.
My next pick is one that I am so excited about. I'm going to read it when we hang up. But it came out last week, and it's The Cemetery of Untold Stories by Julia Alvarez. Julia Alvarez maybe needs no introduction, but in case you haven't heard of her, she is one of the great novelists of our time. She's a master of magical realism. She's a Dominican-American writer, some of her most famous works being In the Time of the Butterflies and How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. In this book, the main character is a celebrated Dominican-American author, like Julia herself, who doesn't want to end up like her friend, who is also a novelist, but who has worked so long and hard to finish her latest book that it is threatening her sanity. So Alma finds out that she has inherited a piece of land back home in the Dominican Republic, her homeland. So she decides to literally move there and then literally bury her untold stories in the ground, like there. That's all fine, except that the characters of those stories start to come to life and they all have a little something to say about their fates. They talk back to Alma and to one another behind her back. They're like rewriting and revising themselves. Among those characters is like dictator Rafael Trujillo's abandoned wife, who she was all but erased from like the official history. There is a doctor who fought in the Dominican underground and escaped to the US. So it's again, the concept itself is already like very alluring to me. And the book was written as Alvarez was going through a health crisis wherein she lost vision in one eye, had to have like a bunch of different surgeries and was seeing double. There was a real moment where she had to consider that this might be her last book if she could even finish it. And that theme of like what happens to all the stories you didn't get to tell is obviously very central to the book. I started it, haven't gotten, I think I'm maybe like 10-15% in. But again, her writing just immediately captivates me every time. So very excited to finish this. Again, that's The Cemetery of Untold Stories by Julia Alvarez.
All right. And my other pick is My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future by Alice Randall. Randall is the first Black woman to co-write a number one country hit. She is the co-writer on Trisha Yearwood's X's and O's, which I cannot claim to be familiar with, but I will probably look it up after this. Randall's tells her story. This is like a part memoir, part history book. I love those. She tells her story as well as her research into the history of Black country music and the first family of Black country music, and explores the Black influence on American country music and culture. I doubt that this book was scheduled to come out around the release of Cowboy Carter, because I don't think we knew when that was going to happen, probably, when this was scheduled, but its timing couldn't be better. I mean, like, you know, what great, you know, publicity you could get for this at this time. So, which is also, I haven't even listened to that yet. I still need to listen to that. But anyway, so this book has amazing reviews. Oh my goodness, you know what's been going on. So this book has amazing reviews and blurbs from a lot of impressive people, lots of great reviews. So I'm looking forward to reading this. It is My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future by Alice Randall.
I want to be very clear that that exasperation was more like, I can't wait for you to get to experience that, not a how dare you, because I would never do that to my friend. But I also wanted to really quickly plug that if you are not a subscriber to The Deep Dive, you should be, if for no other reason than because our editor, Erica Zaffetti, wrote this great, like, bookish companion to Cowboy Carter that gets into, like, the history of country music and, like, Beyonce specifically and, like, why she wrote this album. It's fantastic. And it has a really excellent reading list. And this book might be on it, actually. So anyway, go check that out. It was really fun. My last pick is one that, oh my gosh, I'm going to try to be very brief about, but it's hard because I'm like really excited about it, even though I haven't read a single page of it. And that is Canto Contigo by Johnny Garzavilla. This, I'm going to explain really quickly what mariachi is, because mariachi is like central to this book. So if you don't know, it's a type of Mexican music. The term is generally refers to be like an ensemble of musicians that are typically consisting of lots of violins, trumpets, at least one guitar, including a particular one called a vihuela, and then an acoustic bass guitar called a guitarrón. Some have harps. But anyway, it is like a type of music that the part of Mexico my family is from, like, claims origin for, even though it probably also was born through several of the kind of adjoining states, but very, very popular in Jalisco. I often describe it as like Mexican symphony, because it is just this big like swell of music that like, and those groups play everything from like music that dates back to the 18th century to like more modern stuff now. So the book itself is about Rafael Alvarez, who is a third generation musician and the star of his high school's mariachi group. And in a wild 24 hours, he not only helps lead their group to their 11th consecutive first place win at what you can think of as like mariachi nationals, but also meets, kisses, and almost hooks up with a cutie at said event. And then 8 months later, Rafi is a senior and ready for one final win when his family drops a bomb on them that they're moving to San Antonio, to Texas. And this is a major and devastating move because Rafi is not only having to leave his school and his beloved mariachi group behind, but the most important person in his life, who's his abuelo, which like breaks my heart. And if all that wasn't enough, there's one more thing. And that's that the mariachi group at this new school, which, side note, is called the Selena Quintanilla Perez Academy's Mariachi Todos Colores. Excellent name. Long live Selena. RIP, really. And that group, though, already has a lead vocalist, which is already a bummer because that's like he really wanted to do that. But that vocalist is none other than the hottie from Mariachi Nationals, Ray Chavez. So Rafi wants the top spot. The mariachi director at this new performing arts school doesn't think he's ready for it. And then despite their newfound rivalry for center stage, Ray is still very much cute. And so Rafi is, you know, he cannot help his feelings for Ray. So the two start to get close, but Rafi's ambitions threaten to get in the way of like this thing that's blossoming between them. So by all accounts, this is not only, of course, a rivals to lovers romance, but like a love letter to Mexican culture and family and legacy. Ray is an Afro-Latino trans boy, so I will definitely issue content warnings for racism, homophobia, and transphobia. I cannot wait to read this one. The cover is freaking stunning. And there's also an excerpt of this actually up on bookriot.com if you want to get a little teaser for it. So again, that's Canto Contigo by Johnny Garzavilla. I'm done.
All right. Well, while we're talking about him, I'm just going to roll into paperbacks because his other book is out in paperback today, which is called Andrew and Sandy Were Here. It's about a non-binary Mexican-American teen who falls for the new waiter at their family's taqueria. Also up, Natural Beauty by Ling Ling Huang. This is about a young woman who gets a job at a high-end beauty and wellness store, but the store may have something nefarious going on behind the scenes. The Secret Diaries of Charles Ignatius Sancho by Patterson Joseph. This is historical fiction set in England in the 1700s about a young black man born on a slave ship who spends his days dodging slave catchers and how he ends up having a lot of adventures in England that are beyond his wildest dreams. For You and Only You by Caroline Kepnes. I have never read You, or I think this is like the third or fourth book in the series. But if you are a fan, this one is out in paperback now. Going Zero by Anthony McCartan, about 10 contestants who accept the challenge to stay off the grid for 30 days and let a Google-like technology company hunt them all across the country. Using, you know, surveillance and trying to track them by their bank accounts and their credit cards and their, you know, security cameras and all this stuff. It's a government project. And there's one librarian who's giving them a really hard time. They thought it would be easier than this to find everybody. So, of course, it's a librarian. They're very resourceful. Small Joys by Elvin James Mensa, a story of queer friendship and found family in 1990s England. The Kneeling Man, My Father's Life as a Black Spy Who Witnessed the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. by Letta McCullough-Seletsky. If you see the image of Martin Luther King, if you've seen that famous image of the man pointing, like after MLK has been shot, there are people on the balcony, there is a man kneeling beside him, and that is the author's father. And discusses like his life and how he came to be there. I Am the Walrus by Neil Schusterman and Eric Elfman. This is the first in a sci-fi series about a teen who starts experiencing weird, unhuman-like symptoms. And Thief, Liar, Lady by D.L. Soria, a Cinderella retelling, but a different situation than the Cinderella we know. Apparently, she's not a maid, and she doesn't hate her stepsisters, and she thinks that Happily Ever After is a joke. So those are some paperbacks. We talked about books that we've read, books that we're excited about. What are you going to read next?
Definitely going to read the last two I just talked about, The Cemetery of Untold Stories and Canto Contigo, and also The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, which is finally out. It is like Spanish Inquisition, fantasy, all kinds of fun stuff. I can't wait to read this one. The cover is stunning. I hope it meets my expectations because I'm really, really excited for it. How about you?
I am going to read Private Rights by Julia Armfield. She wrote Our Wives Under the Sea, which I talked about like 800 million times.
Yes.
And this is a speculative retelling of King Lear, apparently. Also, I am reading Blood Rubies by Michael McDowell, which is an older horror novel for this backlist project that I'm working on. And speaking of Michael McDowell, if you don't know him, he was the creator of Beetlejuice, and now I just watched the trailer. Did you watch the trailer for the sequel that's coming out?
Absolutely.
Beetlejuice, which is like genius. I'm kind of angry at how excited I am to see it, you know. But I mean, Winona Ryder is back.
Yeah.
Catherine O'Hara is back. Michael Keaton, obviously. So it's going to be, and Jenna Ortega, is that her name from Wednesday? So she's going to be in it. I think it's going to be great. Or it's not, and I don't care. I'll just be happy. So that is it for us today. You can visit mytbr.co to subscribe to TBR. It only takes a few minutes. That's mytbr.co. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to our awesome audio editor, Caitlin Brame. You can drop us a line at allthebooks@bookriot.com if you want to talk about your area code or Beetlejuice or vampires or anything. Vanessa, where can people find you online?
I'm mostly on Instagram and unfortunately still on Twitter because it's very fun to be on Beyonce's internet at BuenoVCSSD. Yep.
Okay. And I mostly hang out on Instagram at Franzen Comes Alive, where you can see that stuffed scary bird thing.
Galadrius.
And if you want to give us a treat, you can go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is you get your podcasts and leave a rating or review. It helps other book lovers to find us. And as much as we would love to tell you about more books today, we just don't have the time, but you can read about more titles out now in the show notes at bookriot.com/allthebooks, as well as find a link to our weekly new books newsletter. And for more recs or general bookishness, check out bookriot.com. And don't forget to check out our full stable of podcasts at bookriot.com/listen, or just search Book Riot on your podcast player of choice. And in the meantime,
happy reading.